Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
In January of 1941, Americans had a lot to be apprehensive about. Still not fully recovered from the brutal privations of the Great Depression, we watched with fear and sorrow as China struggled under Japanese occupation and nation after nation in Europe fell to Germany. With many Americans still supporting a neutral foreign policy to keep this country out of war, President Roosevelt hoped to rally public support for greater military readiness. And so he made a landmark speech declaring that people in the United States and throughout the world were entitled to four basic freedoms: freedom of speech and religion, freedom from want and fear. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. In the 75 years that followed, the four freedoms have continued to resonate in American and global political culture. But as he will explain, my guest believes we have yet to fulfill FDR's specific vision of freedom, most notably in terms of social equality and widespread economic opportunity. Jeffrey Engel is director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU and editor of the new book, The Four Freedoms, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Evolution of an American Idea. Jeffrey, welcome back to Think.
Hi, thank you for having me again.
We don't normally start discussions about freedom by defining the word because we all feel like we know what it means. But as you pointed out in the book, there is no universally accepted definition.
That's really one of the most fascinating things that drew me to this project in the first place. The idea that we all like freedom, we all accept freedom. Any politician who thinks they're going to campaign against freedom is going to have a very short-lived political career indeed. But no one has the exact same idea of what it means. And more importantly, it's also very time-specific and culturally specific. What Americans think of as freedom is simply different from what Chinese think as freedom, from what people in the Middle East think of freedom, and certainly from the 1940s to today and all throughout history, there's a really different conception of what freedom means. Not so much that we don't like it or do like it, but rather what it means when you get down to brass tacks. What actually does it mean to allow someone else to live the life that they want, potentially if it's in contradiction to what you want?
What did FDR see on the horizon as he looked around and began to write in late December 1940, early January 1941?
Well, he saw storm clouds. There's no doubt that the war was on the horizon from his perspective. Remember, this is early 1941 that he gives this speech. It's his January 41 State of the Union. And by this time, Germany is in complete control of Europe. France has fallen. The Low Countries have fallen. Hitler has not yet invaded Russia. That's still going to be on the horizon 6 months later. But he is bombing Britain. And it looks as though there's going to be not only a long war, but potentially a war that the Allies can't win. And he is very fearful that the United States is going to not only have its own security imperiled by a Nazi victory, but more importantly, from his perspective, that anything that the United States would do to combat tyranny around the world, to combat fascism around the world, would so fundamentally alter American society as to make the American freedoms that we believed valuable, the four freedoms, almost inoperable.
So let's listen to a little bit of what he had to say on that day in January 1941.
The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understandings which will secure to every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants everywhere in the world. The fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world.
This is definitely a speech that seems to look outward. This is not about domestic life in America.
No, it's about a global mission. We have to remember that this is actually, though we think of freedom as something that implies a sense of stability, a sense of contentment, this is a war speech. This is a speech where Roosevelt is trying to rally public opinion to back his rearmament plans, to back his plans to give more arms to the Allies, and really to prepare the United States for the war that he believes is inevitable. Now, obviously, he still thinks at this point that there might be a chance the United States can avoid it, and he's certainly not going to tell Congress and the American people that he thinks war is inevitable. He's trying to tell them that if you do these things, we can keep war from our shores. But he knows that he needs to rally people to go not only fight for themselves, but fight for the whole world. And that's really the whole purpose behind the four freedoms. He says it's not enough to tell people that you need to fight an enemy. You need to give them something to fight for. You need to give them something to come home to. And the four freedoms are all about the better world that he thinks can be created for the United States and the rest of the world through an Allied victory.
For those of us who aren't professional historians, we know what came next, and so it's a little hard to understand sometimes the mindset of people in the moment. Right now, it seems so clear that we needed to arm up and be ready to fight the Second World War. Talk about how our experiences with the First World War had left so many people completely unconvinced that we should be anything other than neutral, and neutral at best, I suppose, and really isolationist at the most extreme.
Yeah, well, we have to take a step back and remember that the debate, in fact, it was really called the Great Debate of the late 1930s, of 1940, of 1941, about whether or not the United States should get involved in the war, was arguably some of the most heated, vitriolic, partisan, angry debate that we've seen in American history, at least in the 20th century. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who was a noted historian, an advisor to Kennedy, and one of the most important intellectual figures of the 20th century, remarked that never in his entire life, and this was a life that included civil rights, this was a life that included the Vietnam War, never in his life did he see anything as bitter and as personally bitter that tore families apart as the idea of what to do before World War II, whether the United States should get involved. And as you mentioned, it's really because of the legacy of the First World War. This is a war where Americans went off with great ideals. That was a very, very difficult war for the United States to enter. But once it did, people bought into the idea, by and large, that this was a war to make the world safe for democracy. It's also a war to end all wars, as President Woodrow Wilson described in 1918.
Worst tagline ever, as it turns out, because it didn't work.
It doesn't work, and it leaves a terrible, bitter memory, especially since all the people who came back after World War I, who thought they had won on the battlefield, realized that they had essentially lost in the negotiating table. They had lost in the intervening years, that war was going to come. And worse yet, we were going to go back and fight another war on the same territory. All that blood and treasure lost the first time was just simply a waste. So there was not a lot of enthusiasm, as one could imagine, for entering the war in World War II. But also, one thing to remember is that the geography still has not changed dramatically from what it was in World War I. Planes existed, of course, planes that could carry bombs across great distances. But there is no bomber that can actually get across the Atlantic or the Pacific Ocean in 1940-1941. They were on the drawing boards, but they didn't actually exist yet. So when President Roosevelt went out and tried to make the case that American homeland security, if you will, a term he didn't use, but American national security, a term he actually invoked and began to use increasingly over the course of his presidency, that was endangered from the Nazis, he had a very difficult case to make, since people could very rightly look and say, you know, the enemy is 5,000 miles away, and that's a long way away.
One of the people who said we really should not be worried about this was Charles Lindbergh. And again, today we know that he was, you know, this sort of landmark aviator. He was an all-purpose superstar back then.
Yes, he was a celebrity in all accounts. But also had within him an increasingly, shall we say, totalitarian streak. Probably the better way to think about it is an increasingly it was increasingly in favor of the efficiency and of the efficacy that the fascist states were able to demonstrate. I mean, one thing to remember is we're coming out of the Great Depression here, and the Great Depression is really a fight for whether or not capitalism can continue to exist. Roosevelt firmly believed that everything that he did for the New Deal was not to reform capitalism, but to save it. That if we didn't do something to get people back in work, if we didn't do something to make sure that people had faith in their system again, that the dictators really would take over all around the world. Well, there are some very good arguments to be made in the 1930s that the dictators actually have the right recipe because they are able to come out of the Great Depression faster. They're able to move their economies along faster. They're able to cut through a lot of red tape. And Lindbergh was a person who really became enamored of German ideology, enamored of the Nazi Party, became a real ally of the Nazi Party in many ways in Germany. He still never gave up the idea that he was an American and he was pro-American, but he really liked the idea of efficiency as a way to really cover up a lot of the problems of capitalism. And Franklin Roosevelt believed that that was really a recipe for disaster, that that was going too far towards the enemy. So to bring this all back full circle, Lindbergh is one of the people who really argued that American security was not endangered by the enemy in World War II. First, because he didn't think that the Germans were quite as bad as they were being made out to be. But secondly, because he says, I'm an aviator. I'm the first man to cross the ocean in a plane. And I did it. And I didn't even bring a toothbrush because I thought it would be too heavy, too much weight. Now imagine a plane that's going to bring all those bombs across and try to get back. It's simply too far. It's simply not a problem. We don't need to worry about this. And in fact, the real threat, he argued, was from a rising dictatorship at home, a rising dictatorship such as from Franklin Roosevelt, a man who had just done something no one else had done before, which is win a third term, a very controversial third term.
And of course, Roosevelt was making the argument that we heard in the Iraq War, which is that, you know, with slightly different circumstances, very different circumstances, you either have to fight what you don't like overseas or you will be fighting it directly on the home front. That was not so easy to convince people of until the attack on U.S. soil at Pearl Harbor.
Yes. Well, the attack at Pearl Harbor ends the entire discussion. This is really one of the reasons that we have forgotten in many ways in our collective historical memory the great debate, because there was never a resolution to it. Americans never actually decided whether or not they should enter the war or not. That fact was decided for them. They were attacked. The moment we were attacked, everybody immediately became involved, supportive. It really was an overwhelming political shift overnight, as one can imagine, with no great surprise. And so because we never actually resolved this issue, it remains sort of an open question for historians. What might have happened to American aid to the Allies if Pearl Harbor doesn't occur?
Why did Roosevelt choose the four freedoms that he chose? There are a lot of things he might have articulated as being important. Why freedom from fear and want, freedom of speech and religion?
You know, when asked what his basic political philosophy was, Roosevelt was a person who's never interested in articulating much when it comes to philosophy. He never wanted to articulate an ideology. He was, by all accounts, one of the most pragmatic presidents we've ever had. When asked what his philosophy was, he said, it's very simple. I'm a Democrat and I'm a Christian. And the best way to understand what he meant by that, I think, is that he believed in the basic tenets of Americanism, which is the basic things that set the United States not so much apart from the world, but rather as an ideal for the world, something that the world could aspire to and that we could aspire to ourselves to make better. And he believed that if people had the right to say what they wanted, well, that's a fundamental plank of American democracy. He also was a very religious man himself, so he believed that people should have the right to worship. Now, it's important to note that he talks about the freedom to worship. He doesn't actually say, it's implicit perhaps, but he doesn't actually say explicitly that people should have the right not to worship. He doesn't actually have that they have the right to choose whatever God they want, that they should choose a God that really represents the way he understands religion. One way to unpack this a little bit and understand what he means by religion is to think back to the incredible portraits that were created by Norman Rockwell, the iconic portraits of the four freedoms, which I'm sure everybody either has in mind or hopefully can Google very quickly. And one of the images of religion shows a series of people of different origins, of different ethnicities, who are all praying together, holding their hands together as though they're Protestants, in essence. And I think when Roosevelt talked about religion, he really understood people to be thinking about God the way that he did, as a person who has an active role in a person's life.
We're speaking this hour with Jeffrey Engel, director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU and editor of the new book, The Four Freedoms, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Evolution of an American Idea. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016. A customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU, Jeffrey Engel. He's just edited a new book called The Four Freedoms, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Evolution of an American Idea. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Jeffrey, you were talking about the freedom of religion and explaining to us that when FDR said this, he meant freedom to be a Christian like I am. Did that extend to, say, Judaism?
It did in time. The one of the things that was really fascinating to learn about the way that freedom of religion evolved since 1941 was essentially the way, if you want to think about it, that we expanded the sphere of who was an acceptable member of a religious party, who was an acceptable religious actor. So you wind up getting this interesting term that only comes to being around this time of a Judeo-Christian ethic, which doesn't exist before, where Jews begin to become included in essentially the good monotheistic religions. Now, of course, one of the problems that we're grappling with today is how far does this extend? Because there are certainly people in this country today who would suggest that, well, Jews and Christians are okay, but the other monotheistic religion is a little bit more problematic. I speak, of course, of Islam. And as we see throughout the course of the 20th century, the sphere keeps on expanding. And it seems to me as a historian that everyone who argues over time that the sphere should not include a certain group, ultimately that group does get in. It just takes time and takes some pushing.
Was there anything implicit in the freedom of religion that encouraged Americans to have empathy for persecuted Jews? If not explicitly in that speech, was it referred to?
The difficulty that Roosevelt faced in dealing with what might just best be described as the Jewish problem in the late 1930s was that Jews were still classified, according to the government, not as a religion, but as a race, and not according to their own nationality as well, which meant, in essence, if you're thinking in immigration terms, a Jew from Hungary and a Jew from Russia and a Jew from Czechoslovakia, they all count as one Jew. Mm-hmm. And so that made it easier for immigration officials to limit the number of Jews who were coming in. And Roosevelt really had no personal interest in increasing the number of Jews who came in, and certainly no political interest in increasing the number of Jews who came in. And it really wasn't until after the war began, and therefore after the Americans really lost any ability to import a lot more people, to allow a lot more people to come in, really wasn't until after the war began that people began to realize the true depth of the horror that was facing the European community and the European Jewish community in particular. So the difficulties that we see looking back and asking about the Holocaust, why didn't Roosevelt do more, are very difficult because we know how things turned out. Yeah. We know how bad things got. But in 1938, 39, 40, 41, when the great debate is going on, no one had any imagination that this completely unimaginable horror was about to take place.
What did Roosevelt mean by freedom from want?
That, I think, was probably the most important one to him personally because, as I mentioned before, he got into the New Deal with the idea that he was going to save American, not only capitalism, but save American democracy at the same time, that the crisis of the Great Depression was enough to really shake to the fabric and shake to the foundation everything that Americans believed in. And he recognized that the only way to ensure that capitalism could continue was to ensure a basic level of, the word he used was security. This is where we get the idea of Social Security from. In fact, this is when he begins to use national security. This is actually what he refers to, not as an external threat, but as an internal threat. The notion that people, in order to be successful in life, in order to have the freedom, if you will, to go out and be good capitalists, to start businesses, to take risks, they had to know that there was what we come to refer to today as a safety net. They had to know that they would not starve in the street, as had been seen in the Great Depression, that they would not lose their homes, as had happened in the Great Depression, that they would not, when they got old, lose the ability to take care of themselves, as had happened during the Great Depression. He really believed that the freedom from want was a freedom that allowed people to expand and do the things that all human beings possibly could, as long as they were free from the notion that they were going to suffer in the end.
So we have a vastly more robust safety net than we did before Roosevelt, but there are lots of holes in it. Where would he have tightened those holes had he had the opportunity that just simply haven't happened?
Well, there's one that's quite obvious, actually, in that Roosevelt was always a proponent and said so in the Four Freedoms speech of universal health care. He thought that that was fundamental to what it meant to as a basic human right, to what it meant to be a human, was not to have to worry about whether or not you were going to be taken care of if you got sick. But one of the fascinating things that happens over the course of the latter half of the 20th century and the 75 years since the freedom from want is that it begins to move essentially on two tracks, if you will. As you mentioned, we have an expanded social safety net from what we had in the 1930s. Social Security is broader. The ways in which government is involved in people's lives is much, much broader than it was in the 1930s. But at the same time, we have become really, across partisan lines, really devoted to this idea that Roosevelt was not comfortable with at all, which is the notion of a fully free market. One can hear different presidents from different ideological perspectives, George W. Bush, say, and Barack Obama, each of them praising the free market as the thing which is not only the way to ensure great prosperity, but really an essential part of what it means to be a human, to be able to trade, to be able to produce as you wish. This is not something that Roosevelt was particularly interested in. He thought that the market itself needed regulation, that the market by itself, when it was free, that's part of what caused the problem of the Great Depression. And it's only in the 1960s and 70s, as conservatism in this country begins to coalesce and become really powerful as a political movement, that the idea of a free market as a way to ensure human freedom begins to take hold.
It is interesting, though, that at the time that the you know, really elevation of the free market as a path for virtually everyone to achieve the kind of success and freedom from want that we want to have, as that was all taking place, you know, Richard Nixon, universal health care came up in the Nixon administration. It was something that he thought wasn't such a bad idea.
No, there's always been a recurring theme in American political circles that health care is really something that if humans could be free from the burden of having to worry about something like whether or not they're going to be taken care of when they're sick, that they would be able to be more productive in American society. I mean, there's a really an interesting cross current here between people who want freedom, meaning the government having no intervention whatsoever in their marketplace, and people who recognize that to have ultimate freedom, the government might actually give people a baseline of support. And let me give you a good example of this. This really comes to a head for Dwight Eisenhower, because he is a person who is very concerned from a personal, political, ideological perspective about growth of government. He believes very firmly that we are heading towards a centralized government, which is going to create an erosion of freedom, what he referred to as a garrison state, that this government would get its hands everywhere, period. Now, having said that, he's also the president who created the interstate highway system because he thought that this is a place where the government could actually help people facilitate production. He's a person who oversaw an incredible national security growth. He's a person who oversaw much more growth of the federal government than we saw during the New Deal. He's a person, therefore, who was really involved in this tension between saying the government has a role and a responsibility to ensure that it doesn't get too big, but it also has a role and responsibility to ensure that people have the opportunity to live their lives in the most productive fashion for the good of the country. And it's really a tension that exists throughout the 75 years since the speech.
When Roosevelt talked about freedom from fear, the idea was this is a goal, and the not-so-tacit implication was, so we don't have this right now.
Right. And this is really one of the great ironies of the speech, is that explicit, really, in Roosevelt's formulation of freedom from fear is the notion that he's going to use fear to get his legislation through Congress, that the only way that we're going to get to a place where we can feel safe from international attack, that we can feel safe in the terms of what we come to understand as our national security, is by doing things because we are so afraid right now. And time and again, we see policymakers, presidents, politicians of all stripes using fear as a way to get their legislation through Congress throughout the Cold War and after. That basically it's very, very effective, especially when we have something as dramatic as a Cold War, which I would argue is really the first and perhaps only time that the United States has faced a truly existential crisis. That is a crisis where you have an enemy that has the power to truly eradicate your way of life and your entire life. That the only way to combat that awesome and horrible thought is by doing things that we'd never done before by expanding the national security state, by building up a military industrial complex such as we had never seen before, that it was only the way to get Congress to approve these things and the American people to approve these things was to scare them. Let me give you a concrete example of this. Very briefly, 1947, the Truman Doctrine, one of the most important and sweeping changes in American foreign policy of the early Cold War, President Truman goes to Congress and asks for money to give to Greece and Turkey, who are both fighting anti-communist insurgencies. Really the first time that we've gone out and given that level of aid to an anti-communist fight. When he met with President Truman met with congressional leaders, they were very explicit. Arthur Vandenberg, who was Mr. Republican at the time, said very explicitly, "Mr. President, the way to get this through Congress is to scare the hell out of the American people." And they did. And fear subsequently was used very effectively as a way to get legislation passed.
Do you think Roosevelt would be surprised at the extent to which fear is still a tool of politics today?
You know, one of the things I like about Roosevelt is I don't think he'd be surprised by much of anything. I think he would be very, very understanding of the fact that politicians of all stripes use his language for their own political purposes, that politicians would use freedom for any political purpose and would use fear for any political purpose. He was, to his core, a politician. I think Roosevelt would be relatively content with the way that we have protected freedom of religion and freedom of speech in particular. I think he'd be very uncomfortable with the way that we protected freedom from want and freedom from fear. I think he would look at us and say, that's a basic part of the human condition. It's something we should strive to get rid of, but I don't see it ever going away.
We have a tweet here that asks, how might the phrase freedom from fear be interpreted in today's political climate with regard to ISIL and the refugee crisis?
Well, I think that's a very good example of how fear can be used to motivate people beyond, personally, what I would say is a reasonable threat, beyond what they could reasonably be concerned about. That when we have to think about the size and the scope of the problems that Americans faced on the foreign front in World War II, Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan, these are major industrial states that is going to require the entire change and revolution of American society in order to defeat, and it's going to take many, many years. Compare that to the existential threat that we faced during the Cold War, which is a nation where the Soviet Union had 20,000 nuclear weapons aimed at the United States. Just stop and think about that number, 20,000 nuclear weapons, each of them multiple times bigger than Hiroshima or Nagasaki, aimed at the United States. Now, compare that to the threats that we face today, which are bad, which are difficult, but they are not existential threats. And therefore, I think the fact that politicians have used this fear of ISIS, of ISIL, of terrorism to make Americans believe that their entire society is at risk, that's really only done, I think, for political purposes. I think that that's really not because that there is a dire threat, but because they find it's going to be good for their electability, frankly.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Melody in Dallas. Hello, Melody.
Hey. I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts on the role that race played or did not play in the Four Freedoms speech, because he famously said it's the rights of men of every creed and every race wherever they live. Yet if you look at the events subsequent to that, with segregation of African Americans, the executive order to inter the Japanese, the Zoot Suit riots, that it really wasn't extended to people of color or people of different extractions. I'd just be interested in hearing your thoughts on that.
Thanks so much for your call. And, of course, Norman Rockwell didn't put a lot of people of color in his depictions of these things either.
No, there really are no depictions of color of Rockwell. As I like to say, the only thing of any color in Rockwell's Freedom of Want poster, for example, is the turkey, which just came out of the oven and is nicely bronzed. It was really a lily white scene beyond that. It's really a great question that you ask, because it helps us understand both the politics that Roosevelt faced and his own idealism. The Four Freedoms were really an ideal. We have to remember that they are an aspiration. They are where America's going. They are why we're fighting the war. They are the better society that we can create, which is not to say we're there yet. And one of the problems that Roosevelt faced, despite any notion that he had of trying to move what we would understand as civil rights forward, which was, by the way, not a particular priority for him, but it was not something he was against, is that he was aligned with Southern Democrats. The Democratic Party is particularly strong in the South. That's his base. He knows he cannot win Congress and cannot win re-election without keeping the South solid. And the South is a place that was more interested in racial segregation than other parts of the country, and certainly at the forefront of their own political identity. So for Roosevelt to say we want to move towards a better future is not to say that he had the political room, in his opinion, to actually do anything about it in the short or medium term. And the internment of Japanese Americans and the difficult treatment of African Americans throughout his presidency is a great example of that. Some of the landmark moments in civil rights legislation on the federal level, most explicitly the desegregation of the military, doesn't come until after Roosevelt is gone. This is not a man who's willing to, because he's a pragmatic politician, put everything on hold for his broader New Deal for the idea of improving race relations.
Even domestically in the Jim Crow era, you had African Americans asking for freedom and justice. You have Southern segregationists, that, as you mentioned, who were, you know, Democrats, and they were part of Roosevelt's party. And they're demanding freedom from federal mandates that would require them to provide equal rights under the law.
Yeah, it really forces us to recognize that the battle for freedom is really a battle about how we understand the America that we want to live in. There are those on Roosevelt's side who think that they want more expansion of the government in order to allow everyone the opportunity to live the life that they can. And that's contrasted with another group, usually typically understood as a more conservative group, that wants freedom from the federal government telling them how to live their life, even if the way they live their life might actually be detrimental to the lives of others in the case of segregation. And it's really a problem that is at the core, I think, of what it means to be an American in the 20th century, is trying to understand that the American values that a person holds, if they are built upon a system that from its origins was built upon structural racism, structural deficiencies, structural problems in American society, that if how can we hold fast to our ideals if our ideals are built upon something which at its start anyway was something that we would not approve of today? And consequently, this is why I like to think of Roosevelt's Four Freedom as a place to envision, as a place to go forward, as a place to look towards to make American society better, knowing that things that we've done in the past are not necessarily perfect just because we've done them in the past.
Jeffrey Engel is my guest. He's director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU and editor of a new book called The Four Freedoms, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Evolution of an American Idea. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU, Jeffrey Engel. He's recently edited a new book called The Four Freedoms, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Evolution of an American Idea. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. To the extent that FDR's vision of freedom was not achieved socially, what do you think he would do? Would there be a guaranteed income? Would there be, besides health care, what else, in what other ways do you imagine that if we had carried forth his vision, that the safety net might look different today?
You know, that's a great question. I've never thought about that before. I'm not sure it would be that much different, because I think Roosevelt, remember, he's a product of his time. He's still fundamentally a fiscal conservative, if you will. And you got to recall the history here. He creates new programs in 1933 and 34, what we understand as the first New Deal, which, of course, expand the social safety net, get a lot of people back to work, in essence. And then the economy starts to do better. And the first thing he does when the economy starts to do better is he says, great, we're done. Now let's get back to balanced budgets.
And then the economy did worse.
Exactly. The Roosevelt recession of 37. And consequently, I think that I'm hard pressed to think that he would have gone personally too far past what he envisioned in terms of a safety net. He clearly wanted health care. There's no doubt about that. And he clearly wanted old age care. And he clearly wanted unemployment. And he didn't want people starving on the streets. And he didn't want people sleeping on the streets. That's about the limit, I think, of where he thought government needed to go. Now, I will tell you, one of the real problems that Roosevelt faces as the war progresses from 1942 on is that he very quickly pivots from what he referred to as Dr. New Deal to Dr. Win the War, that he thought the war is the most important thing, even as those around him who came up through his own political upbringing from the political left, including his own wife, Eleanor, kept reminding him that there's never going to be a better time to reform American society than during a war. It's a plastic moment. We can make a lot of changes for the future. And Roosevelt simply was not interested in that. He was interested in winning the war first, which is in direct contravention, if you will, from one great example of what happened in Great Britain, where British policymakers, even the coalition government headed by a conservative Winston Churchill, recognized that the only way to get the people really involved was to promise them a transformed society after the end of World War II. So at the end of World War II, especially when the Labour Party wins in Britain in 1945, they immediately develop universal health care, as a good example. And it's really a question of whether or not you use the war as a plastic moment to make change or use the war as something that needs to be completed quickly, which was Roosevelt's view.
It's a tough comparison to make, though, even if you look at the sizes of the population of the two countries and the state of Great Britain following World War II as opposed to the state of the United States.
Yeah, I don't think that's why Roosevelt was particularly thinking that it was going to be something that could be done in his political lifetime. You know, one of the people who was really pushing Roosevelt from the left was his own vice president, Henry Wallace, and who was really one of the most progressive, one might even say radical, members of the administration, arguing constantly not only for universal disarmament, but also for universal health care, but also for everything which we would understand as a liberal wish list, if you will, from the political left. He, of course, gets dumped by Roosevelt in 1944 in favor of Harry Truman. Why? It's all because of this issue of how much we're going to fight the New Deal or fight the war. Roosevelt simply was not interested in having somebody like Wallace potentially lose him votes in the South by arguing for things like civil rights. So instead, they go to a man who is really much more pliable and much more amenable to Southern policies, a man from Missouri, Harry Truman.
You make the point in the book that throughout the world, at different points in history after the Second World War, many people who, to American sensibilities, are doing things antithetical to freedom are using this banner of freedom to justify their ideas and their actions. You know the example of Ho Chi Minh and LBJ. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, one of the things that is amazing is that people use the word freedom. They use it for themselves. They believe that they are fighting for freedom. And yet they're oftentimes fighting against each other. Ho Chi Minh and LBJ are good examples. Ho Chi Minh very famously used the Declaration of Independence, the American Declaration of Independence, and Thomas Jefferson's words as a model for the Vietnamese Declaration of Independence, arguing that all men want to be free. Needless to say, he was not considered a freedom fighter by Lyndon Johnson, who thought that the totalitarian communist nature of the government that Ho wanted to set up was antithetical to freedom. So we have this incredible example in the 50s and 60s of American leaders and Vietnamese leaders, who of course become more of an issue in the 60s from the American perspective, both arguing that they are for the cause of freedom even as they're fighting each other. A more modern example for me is even more striking, that we have, of course, lots of examples of George W. Bush after 9/11 speaking of the importance of human freedom, that human freedom is a gift from God, that human freedom is universal, that we are the fighters for freedom and will bring freedom to the world. This is really the whole basis of his second inaugural in 2005, the Freedom Agenda, as it was referred. We have at the same time, almost in conversation, lots of speeches from and statements, or really statements, they weren't speeches, released from Osama bin Laden, saying that we are the true freedom fighters. We are fighting for freedom, that we are fighting against the oppression of the other side, against the oppression of the West, against the oppression of the infidels, and that we are the ones who are on the side of freedom. And I think it's just a good example that people will come out and use this word because they expect people to cheer it, even though it means very different things depending on who's listening and who's saying.
Well, and of course, it can be used in really deliberately cynical ways and manipulative ways. But inherently, there is no such thing as pure freedom, right? Because I don't know if you smoke, I don't smoke. But let's say one of us wants to smoke. I want a smoke-free environment. You want to smoke. Whose freedom takes precedence?
Well, and that's really at the tension of what philosophers like to refer to as between negative and positive freedoms, that there are negative freedoms, that is something the government can't do to you or should not do to you. It should not impinge upon your freedom of speech. It should not impinge upon your freedom of religion. And then there are positive freedoms, which is something the government should give to you in order to ensure that you can become the best human you can be, something like freedom from want. But we really get the rubber hits the road very quickly when we start to parse out what we mean and what we're willing to be comfortable with these freedoms. You know, the classic example, of course, is, you know, I have freedom of speech, but I can't say something that's going to spark violence.
Right.
And consequently, what does that mean? And the government has really interpreted that largely to say you have freedom of political speech. You're not necessarily have freedom to say something that's going to cause immediate harm to someone else. And religion's another great example of this, that we believe that people should have freedom of religion. There's almost nobody in this country who will stand up and say we're against freedom of religion. But now try to do a thought experiment for yourself. Try to picture what that means if you say, okay, well, in that case, am I comfortable with religions that are not what I would consider normally American, caricatured American, not Protestant, not Jewish, not Catholic? What if they decide to come to the United States and start proselytizing in the schools? Well, people will immediately become very uncomfortable. I'm thinking about my elementary school, to be honest, you know, that people would be very, very comfortable having Christian people give a presentation about Christmas, having a Jewish people give a presentation about Hanukkah. But now I'm going to have somebody from the mosque of ISIS come and give a presentation on what they believe. Well, no, that's simply not going to happen in the elementary school that I went to, or the elementary school that my kids go to today. And yet we stop ourselves and say, but don't we believe in freedom of religion? Shouldn't we allow people to speak? And the way that we make the distinction usually is when you begin to speak violence and when you begin to preach something that's going to physically harm someone else.
We find ourselves in this uncomfortable position when it comes to protection of hate speech as well,
which is a really vivid issue for American college campuses today. And frankly, I think one that has gone too far in many ways.
The questions of microaggressions, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think that what we need to do is this is getting a little bit away from Franklin Roosevelt, just to me, but what we need to do, I think, is to train people on a college campus and in our society more broadly not only to speak in a way that doesn't harm other people, but also to speak in a way that you don't feel harmed. That we need to train people that you can disagree with somebody without violently opposing them. And I think, frankly, if we began to teach that more on our college campuses, we might be able to see it more in our political environment as well.
Did Roosevelt's Four Freedoms really teach the rest of the world anything? Is anybody truly looking to the United States as an exemplar of how to be free? And I don't ask that with any particular cynicism. I'm genuinely
curious. I think people around the world continue to look to the United States over the last 75 years as a beacon of freedom. Now, what we need to remember is that when people say that they want to be free and they look at the Americans, they are free. They are on the side of freedom. That doesn't necessarily mean that they want to be American. Let me give you a really concrete example of this that sometimes troubles people. If we look back at Tiananmen Square, if you look back at the student protests of 1989, students there carried banners that said, "We want freedom, we want democracy." And by the way, they were very savvy and they put those signs in English. Why? Because CNN was there and NBC was there. The global audience was watching. It's very clear that they were trying to appeal to Americans to think that their cause was their own. It's also very clear from the language that the students were using that they did not want an American-style democracy for the most part. What they really wanted, for the most part, speaking with a broad brush, was an improved Chinese society. They wanted the Communist Party to get rid of corruption. They wanted people to make sure that they could get equal opportunity for jobs when they graduated from college, which was a big issue for the students, as you can imagine, at Tiananmen Square. The fact that the students who were at the top of the class wouldn't matter if you were to got good grades. It only mattered if your father was a member of the party or connected in the party. They wanted to get rid of that style of corruption. Those are the kinds of democratic improvements that those students were arguing for, which is not what Americans typically thought of when they saw signs saying, "We want freedom, we want democracy." So it is true that both sides wanted this idea of freedom. And it is true that it was important for Americans to have a good, in my opinion, to have a good deal of sympathy for the students because we're both fighting for freedom. But we shouldn't believe innately that people who say they want freedom all want exactly the same political style of government.
Do you think it's fair to say that that American culture really elevates freedom above justice, above other, important human values? Do you think freedom is number one for American identity?
I think freedom is number one in terms of how we identify ourselves. And I think we can see this very much coming down the road. Well, honestly, we can see it recently in some of the more controversial issues over gay marriage, for example. What is the cry of those who say that a person should not be required to fulfill their civic duty or their professional duty, their duty to follow the law, if you will, if you're a county clerk? If it's a violation of your own personal religious views, well, we say, well, this is a violation of religious freedom. And once you use the F word, if you will, it's a really hard political trump card. It's a really hard thing to refute. And that actually is more powerful as political rhetoric than any more complex understanding of what it means to have civic engagement and the responsibilities that a person has to civic society to follow laws. Freedom is a really powerful word.
Do you think we embraced freedom as this particular value because of our origin story, you know, throwing off the yoke of colonial rule?
You know, as a historian, I'm sort of professionally uncomfortable with thinking of the founders as exemplars of freedom because, frankly, most of them owned slaves. It's very difficult, and I think that is the central paradox of American history, and that's something we're going to be wrestling with for hopefully centuries still to come in terms of, because the country will be around for centuries still to come, that we have a man like Thomas Jefferson who says all men are created equal and implicitly all men are created free, who also at the same time had many
asterisk with white skin.
Right, right. Yeah. Who had many hundreds of people under his own who were toiling every day to make his white life possible.
Yeah.
And yet we need to stop and not denigrate at the same time and recognize that the ideals that Jefferson and others expounded at the start were really crucial to who we are today and were really good ideas. The idea that all men are created equal is a good thing. And I think that's really at the heart of the four freedoms that Franklin Roosevelt, at the moment that America was about to face one of its great national crises, recognized that this is a time when we can improve ourselves and improve our society and listen, if you will, as Lincoln would have suggested, to the better angels of our soul.
So how can we be sure that our American understanding of freedom in the 21st century represents the purest and most honorable application of the word that is practically possible?
I think we need to do something, honestly, that's very, very difficult, which is we need to recognize that free peoples around the world may choose policies that we don't like. And we saw this, really, the rubber hit the road during the Arab Spring recently, where we saw democratic revolutions take the streets, take the governments, take the ballot box. And then when they voted in people who did not like us and we did not like them for all kinds of geopolitical reasons. And we need to take a step back and recognize that that's innately a good thing, that if we really believe in a world full of democracies, we have to be willing to recognize that our own democracy is certainly imperfect, but we get better. And consequently, the world will have a world full of democracies that is imperfect. But because it's full of freedom, we'll hopefully get better.
Jeffrey Engel is director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU and editor of the new book, The Four Freedoms, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Evolution of an American Idea. Jeffrey, thank you so much for making time for us today.
Always good to talk to you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy with help on the phones today from Alex Smith. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.